Hello and welcome to the Light Forest podcast. I'm your host Dave, and this is a journey of exploration to bring more light into how we live and regenerate our planet. Welcome to episode 10 of the podcast, and in this conversation, we explore the country of Myanmar through Burmese Buddhism and learn about how Buddhist values are bringing light into the resistance movement against the military. Taking us on this journey, we have Joa McKee, a trainer, podcaster, and humanitarian advocate with deep connections to Myanmar as a longtime practitioner and researcher of Burmese Buddhism. Guests familiar with Myanmar may even recognize his voice as host of the Inside Myanmar podcast, where he shines a light on the intersections of Buddhism with social change and activism. He's also founder of Better Burma, a humanitarian organization providing aid and support to the people of Myanmar since the armed open conflict between resistance groups and the junta. In this conversation, we get into some of the deep contradictions that run through Buddhism in Burma. How does a country that sought to center around vipassana and meditation become one of the most violent regions on the planet? We learn about the ways Buddhist practices such as vipassana, metta, and others are helping leaders in resistance groups, forming, for the lack of a better word, a non-violent movement as a path to peace and reconciliation. Joa has spoken to hundreds of people through his podcast, which informs his own gift of communication, but also he carries many, many stories from the people he's spoken to, some of which he shares with us today. Joa shows us a way to bring more light into a life as an activist. He walks us through his own journey, starting as a Vipassana meditator, and the many insights he's gotten along the way about Myanmar, but also himself. He shares how his practices inform his life, his values, and provide a source of energy and compassion, which he says fuels his ability and drive to make change in his world around him. This episode was recorded earlier in February. More recently, you may have heard that an earthquake measuring 7.7 on the Richter scale has ripped through Myanmar just a few days ago. The situation there is extremely dire. Joa's organization, Better Burma, is on the ground coordinating relief efforts, getting important supplies and resources to the people in need. The link to his fundraising campaign is front and center in the show notes. If you're listening to this, I would love if you could check it out and share what you can. Buddhism has brought a lot of light into my life. Since moving to Thailand, I've spent a lot of time at temples learning the Vipassana practices. I've learned from monks, had conversation with monks, and just in general, be more attuned and be in touch with the kinds of spiritual philosophies of Buddhism. Equally, I've also been able to see how Buddhism is also a religion, an institution of violence, of power, of control, of hierarchy. The conversation with Joa, I think, delves into some of these paradoxes. I've also developed an intimate relationship with Myanmar living in Chiang Mai. Many of my close friends are Burmese or from that region. Through my organization, DigiCNX, I've hosted several events with researchers, activists, and others trying to better understand the situation, explore new perspectives, new ways of using technology. And it's in this context that I met Joa. So I'm really delighted to bring Joa onto the podcast and share this conversation with you. As you'll hear, Joa speaks with a lot of reverence, with a lot of compassion, and he really lives by the values that he talks about. The path he's chosen is not easy. The Myanmar resistance movement can often be dark, dangerous. There's a lot of diversity of identities, of opinions, of suffering, of history. It is not easy to stitch that together and to rebuild a country and create a democracy. Yet, many people are trying, risking their lives to do so. I hope that the resistance movement in Myanmar can become a beacon of hope for all of us. While we have not had to stand up in arms, or we have not had to rebuild our nations from ground up, we might have to one day. On that note, I will leave you to the conversation with Jawa.
Jawa, welcome to the Light Forest podcast. So, as we stand on the edge of the forest, looking in together, there's many threads and directions we could take our conversation. But I feel like the nice starting point might be to talk actually about Myanmar, but not so much about what's Myanmar today. Take us back to some of your roots in terms of what Myanmar stands for as far as Buddhism, as far as practice around Vipassana and meditation. I mean, you've written a meditator's guidebook. Guide us through what Myanmar means from this angle.
Yeah, so I mean, much of the mindfulness movement, the meditation that swept around the world, much of it can be traced to a 19th, 20th century monk, Ledi Sayadaw, who was trying to find ways to preserve Buddhism in the face of colonial occupation of the British. And through doing so, had to reach down to the original teachings of the Buddha, but find a way to make them relevant to a rapidly changing society. And what he formulated was a way to make these teachings more accessible to a wider number of people, including lay people, women, elderly, children, creating everything from nursery rhymes and poetry to manuals and essays that contrasted the Buddhist teachings with the latest understandings of science and technology and biology in the West. Not being afraid of these things, as challenging as religion, as many others were at the time. And through his reformulations, then came along several decades later, a generation later, different teachers that either directly or indirectly would follow in his inspiration, a Mahasi Sayadaw or Seaju Ubakin most notably, and also those names are known outside of Myanmar, but also teachers like Sunlun Sayadaw or Mogok Sayadaw or Monyan Sayadaw or others that are big in Myanmar, but didn't so much have lineages outside. And they came to develop specific meditation techniques, we can say. Lady Sayadaw never said, first you do this, and then you do this, and 3 days you do this, and 2 days you do this, and focus exactly in this way. And in the post-war era, when Burma got its independence, the prime minister, U Nu, very much felt that the national identity of his new country should in part be meditation, Buddhism, but also very specifically meditation. He said that one member of every household should become a meditator, which also then splits this dynamic I talked about before, because what about the non-Buddhist people that live in the country? You know, this might be so inspiring for us that look at where meditation has come to us today. But, you know, what about those ethnically and religiously diverse people?
But perhaps he was speaking on the level of the Dhamma and the idea of that Vipassana maybe transcends even Buddhism.
Well, he might have been, but that's a hard argument to make at the time, because you're making that argument while you're simultaneously pursuing Burmanization policies and also various missions at various times that are conversion of Buddhism across the country. So it's, you know, the idea of Vipassana being non-sectarian, as it's really promoted today in the West, anyone from any background can come and take a course, and there's no linkage to a religion. In Burma, even today, that's a lot harder. I think it's a lot more challenging for a Christian or Muslim minority to come to a Vipassana center in Burma, where these arguments trying to separate these two haven't really been made so much. They're much more aligned. And so that was more problematic, but on the other hand, it did give a boost to the Vipassana and mindfulness movement, because there was state support in terms of initiatives and ideology and actual funding that went towards identifying and promoting leading Vipassana teachers that were capable of leading this mission. And so that really gave a boost to in this post-war independence period, to have this individual agency to realize that you, no matter who you were, what your walk of life was, probably you were a Buddhist. I think I would make the argument it'd be hard for a non-Buddhist to feel this included in this, but certainly for a Buddhist, opportunities of seeking spiritual salvation and liberation were available at this time, like never before, for all kinds of reasons. And then eventually, we can get into this later, but eventually that spirit then found the hippies that were rejecting their own lifestyle and counterculture for all kinds of ways. And they found this message and kind of made it their own. And that's the simplified version, I guess you could say, of how the mindfulness movement then really started up, going back to a 19th century Burmese monk.
And in fact, the Goenka system of meditation, which when I meet most practitioners around the world, they tell me that Goenka is their system. That seems to be one of the most mainstream, sort of globalized Vipassana system.
That's right. I mean, Goenka, he's an Indian, from an Indian family, grew up in Burma, and his teacher was a Burmese Buddhist, Sayaji Ubakin, who was a government minister. And the whole Ubakin's mission started because Unnu, the prime minister, circulated a government memo that was allowing and even actually encouraging, incentivizing government ministers to have Buddhist shrines in their room and to also make use of teachings and precepts and meditation. And so here's an example of state support going into a Buddhist initiative, which then ultimately developed into an independent meditation center, which is where Goenka took his first course, and the whole Goenka mission started because of that.
Yeah, wow. So maybe walk us through what pulled you into Myanmar then.
Well, the passion of meditation.
Yeah. What was your experience like then going to Myanmar and starting that journey?
Yeah, so I went to Burma first as a meditator, as a tourist in 2003, and I was an absolutely dedicated, devoted Vipassana meditator in the tradition of SN Goenka, having sat courses, served courses, long courses. I had left my work entirely for a hiatus just to focus on meditation, living in a meditation center in Japan. Everyone talked about Burma with reverence. You know, you have to go there. So I went in 2003. I spent a month, and again, this is, I can time travel back to who I was there, but I also have to acknowledge the naivete of what Myanmar was really like in ways I didn't understand. But through that naivete, you know, I saw a Burmese Buddhist society that was in line with the spiritual development I wanted to achieve. To say another way, meditation was less common 20 years ago. Some people thought it was pretty interesting and some thought it was pretty weird. And I suddenly find myself in a place where this kind of weird activity, in some ways you have to do a bit in the corners and, you know, not kind of outside the norms of Western society. I could go to a pagoda, any pagoda, just sit in meditation for an hour with these Buddha images and pagoda spears ahead of me and inspiring me. And I could just sit in the open and everyone around me is supporting me. They're supporting me with love and support and happiness. And, you know, my spiritual practice is completely aligned with the values of the society, or so I thought at the time. Again, for a privileged Westerner coming to pursue this spiritual practice, I just felt there was support in all directions to continue in ways that I wasn't experiencing in the West. And so that was something that really moved and impressed me.
That seems like a pretty awesome way to enter in a country and experience that. You know, you referenced your naivete. What were there maybe some of those moments where maybe that illusion, if you will, started to break, that you felt what you thought you saw wasn't quite standing up?
Well, that's a great question. And there's a lot of anecdotes I can give, but one in particular, which kind of still, when I think about this, it still allows me to hold the contradiction and kind of, you know, the painful, awkward contradiction this tale represents, is if you've been to Burma, you might notice that pretty much any little hill area, anything with a view, some community or another will put a pagoda there. And so whenever you're walking and you see a hill and you look up, you'll see this gleaming golden pagoda. And as a meditator, it always gave me this inspiration. And I'd kind of wax eloquent, romantic about it. You know, oh, in our countries, you know, developers buy this and they make their mansions. And you know, this is for the privileged. And here, these are these communal places that are serene and peaceful. And they're a reminder of the Buddhist teachings. And you could go to these pagodas. They're well-maintained. They're well-taken care of. You can stand on top and look at the town. You can meditate there. And oh, this is a society I want to be in. You know, that's a real, there's truth in that, you know, there's truth in those feelings, but that's also naive in terms of knowing what goes into pagoda construction, what goes into the donations and the religious funds that are given there. And perhaps, you know, even more tragically, the thing that really just shocked me and saddened me when I learned is that the Burmese military has a history of going into non-Buddhist places, tearing down their religious monuments, destroying churches, destroying crosses, forcibly using the labor of non-Buddhist populations to build Buddhist pagodas on a hill. And so how do you bring these convergent and really combative realities together? That is certainly, maybe there's some pagodas that were constructed by dedicated Buddhists with pure volition that just wanted to express their devotion. But maybe there were other pagodas that were forcibly constructed. And am I experiencing a wealth and a depth of devotion looking at a religious structure that is actually the source of violence? And what does that mean? Does that mean my feelings are less genuine, or I have some complicity in this? Or is there a way to acknowledge my own feelings and experience of inspiration this gives me, while also acknowledging that that this is a destructive pattern of the society that people under it are suffering from? It's very confusing.
Yeah, I think from the outside looking in as well, I always find it awkward is almost to see if vipassana or meditative practices are about finding peace within and also about compassion, yet so much of the religion around Buddhism is formed in such a way. At Light Forest, part of my journey is trying to understand the roots of where things have kind of started to go wrong, where the world we have today, which is creating toxic air, yeah, or wars, or algorithms that are manipulating our attention, at some point, somewhere, seeds were sown that have created the world today. Where do you think Buddhism, maybe in Myanmar, or maybe even broadly, however you feel comfortable, where do you think that seed of metta, of compassion, of the Dhamma started to become into this institution of violence and bending people against their will?
Yeah, so, you know, one thing I would say is that I think that it's really important to hold those contrasting realities. And I've spoken to meditators who come, they just want, their foreign meditators, they just want their personal experience of looking at that pagoda and feeling joy and inspiration. And you try to explain these other realities. I'm not here for politics. I'm not interested in that. And really, it's kind of like, no, I just want to live in this bubble. Don't tell me anything that interferes with the version of reality I want to create. On the other side, you might talk to human rights workers or journalists and express the real devotion that many Burmese Buddhists and foreigners feel looking at that. Oh, that's hogwash. You know, how can anyone feel anything when we know this violence behind? So it's really hard to hold these two realities. To answer your question you just asked now, I would say that one of the real insights I would say I would have by trying to have one foot in the more spiritual Buddhist world and one foot in the reality that we're all living in is this really kind of imperfect correlation between one's spiritual development and how that gets translated to a nation or society. And I've thought about this more and more lately. And I think there's just so many examples that we can cite from well-known literature, famous figures, as well as in smaller scales of people I know and see in front of me and all over Burma, of cases where individual actions of spiritual growth or renunciation or qualities that are developed are then trying to be scaled up, you can say, in terms of policy or structure of society that are disastrous. And not to go way off a tangent with, you know, maybe a controversial take that's outside of this, but I think one can make an argument that, you know, go to Gandhi. Like, Gandhi had some, personally speaking, he had some really tremendous ethical and spiritual qualities that he lived by. But I think nationally, in some of his visions of India, I think were not so much how people might want to actually physically live in a society. I think that's just one example that you could bring to the passionate meditators in the West, in America, as well as Burmese Buddhist society in Myanmar, of looking at, you know, what does it mean when these things aren't quite so translated? Or maybe we have to translate them in a different way, where some great insight or spiritual path that you're on, when you try to scale that up into the policy or societal reforms or such, sometimes they're absolutely just disastrous.
Yeah. A big question of inquiry as well is, as we try to recreate our worlds and try to, in Myanmar's case, build a democracy, or globally trying to build new systems, feeling there's also this connection with our inner self and the sense of the world being an image of our mind or being a reflection of our minds, and this need to almost have these personal healing journeys while also seeing that the world is closely connected to that. But it's a very difficult thing to even articulate, and it's a very difficult thing to try to speak about in terms of policy when so much of our inner worlds are invisible, and it's difficult to see that. And with your podcast today, which I love, it's so awesome to hear from the so many characters that you have on. And I think one thing that is particularly relevant to Light Forest is your focus on the intersection of Buddhism and social change, social justice, activism and this idea that in Myanmar today, where there's a lot of violence, there are other ways from which maybe change can happen. What is the, I think most listeners might be familiar with some of the most, you know, violent, you know, movements that are going on. What are some of the non-violent, if you will, or engaged Buddhist methods, if you will, that are going on in Myanmar today that you think are noteworthy?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think the violent activities, for obvious reasons, get a lot more attention, and the non-violent ways of resistance or the non-violent ways of supporting your community under the radar are lesser known. And I think there are a lot of those things that are happening in very beautiful ways. One part I would call attention to is just the humanitarian assistance that's going on and just how many monasteries, and for that matter, churches and mosques, I know about monasteries in particular, how many Buddhist monasteries have been turned over into basically refugee centers, how much they're caring for their community, how much they're being a repository of donations and medicine and education and food that are coming in and that are being shared with refugees and being taken care of when whole villages are destroyed and tens of thousands of homes that have been destroyed by the military then have found shelter there and are being protected there. I think there are also figures, you know, there are particular figures that call upon Buddhist teachings, whether they're democratic leaders or activists or monks or meditation teachers, or for that matter, even fighters that might be engaged in violence, but that for the nonviolent parts, I think that are calling upon Buddhist understandings and not just Buddhist understandings as theory, certainly that's part of it, but also meditative insights from direct experience. And to me, this is where, when I talked about my discomfort with how you scale up a spiritual path into actual policies, state policies, or structuring of society, I think that's where things don't turn out so well. I think where they do turn out well is when that meditation, when those direct meditation experiences have refined and changed and transformed you as a person, and through that inner transformation then leads you to respond in ways that have more wisdom and more humanity and more understanding. And I think there's examples of that as well that you can find in individuals and the way that they've gone about things.
Well, I'd love to hear any examples that you might be able to share about this in particular. I think it's really important.
Sure. I mean, so one of the interviews that really stood out to me was a Burmese monk, Ashin Kovida, and which listeners are welcome to check out on our podcast. But he's doing any number of things to advocate for a form of Buddhism that is more inclusive, that is not nationalistic, not violent, not scared or have phobias about other religions, that wants to live in a country where Buddhism can operate without state protection, but can flow and flourish with all other religions and all live peacefully side by side. And really arguing for this more, we could say, more progressive version of Buddhism that you don't hear about. And I think that, and as in the course of our discussion, as he was, you know, really just articulating the form of Buddhism that he's promoting and standing by, and really how different that is from the military's version of something much more nationalistic, more violent, more superstitious, you know, engaging more in superstitions and kind of material spiritualism than actually doing the hard work. And just the extent to which Ashin Kovida is really promoting inner meditation and transformation as the development of the practice rather than some quick fix and getting there or some get rich kind of idea. I asked him, you know, why are we not hearing more about this? Why is this voice not being amplified? Is there more that you could be doing to make this heard, you know, inside or outside the country? And he said that when the 969, the Mabatha movement started out, anti-Islam sentiments being promoted, nationalist monks, Western media descended on the country wanting to promote and amplify this story, which they should. That's a good story to promote. But Ashin Kovida, along with other progressive monks that very much disagreed with this nationalist tenor that had taken hold, told the reporters, yeah, great that you report on this, but also please get our voice as well, because we've been arguing with these guys for years and we don't like what they're doing. They don't represent the way that we see what the religion is, the faith that we hold, the meditation we practice. And so please make sure that you also understand what we're trying to do to argue a different version of practice. And despite they're pleased to be included in stories, they weren't. And so all of the stories, just because it was sexy, they just talked about, you know, this more hateful version. As Ashin Kovida said, this, you know, when a tiger bites a man, this is not a story. But when a man bites a tiger, this is a story. And peaceful monks advocating for a loving form of Buddhism, where's the news in that? But hateful monks advocating for a violent form of Buddhism, that sells. And so that became further amplified and further extended. But, you know, that's not to say that there are not many monks who felt that way and many Buddhists who felt that way. But as things got ramped up, and as the West reported on it and amplified it, and then there became a reaction back from Burmese Buddhists that they felt like they were being attacked, the middle ground kind of fell away, and it became extremists on both sides and accusations on both sides. And so, you know, there were many Burmese Buddhists who were just shocked and horrified by what was happening with the Rohingya, who, you know, some of these more nationalistic tone that the Sangha was taking, they felt uncomfortable by, and they just couldn't speak up, they couldn't speak out, because it became unsafe for them with both extremes getting further apart. So a lot of those people just stayed silent until after the coup. And then after the coup, when the bottom fell out, then you started to hear more of these voices that have been so silent or so ignored for these years starting to come out and finally, you know, reshape what their own version of Buddhism was and what they hoped their country's Buddhism could become.
One of the many perverse incentives of our planet when it comes to media and reporting and influence of opinions. Can we be curious about Shinkovida and this idea of direct experience of meditative insights, bringing that into action and bringing that into change? What's their practice like, if you're familiar with how they actually integrate practice together with collective movements?
I want to answer that question, but I actually thought you were going a different way, and I want to say something. The question I thought you might be asking, because it's also relevant, there's a question about to what degree should monks become involved in advocating for societal changes in politics, and or should they just stick to more of their meditation and their religious duties? And when I asked Shinkovida and others, I think it was a Shinkovida who answered this that always stuck in my mind, where I said, well, what would you say to those who say you're talking about these, you're talking about wider issues, some would say to stick to this? He said, do you know how much I would just like to be a meditation teacher and nothing else? Do you know how much I'd like to live in a society that was safe and free enough that that's what I got to focus on? Do you think I like to have to focus on these other parts of things that are outside of my normal domain? But I can't just sit and teach meditation, because there's bullets flying through. There's students that are coming that aren't safe, that are being nabbed away by the military. So we have to fix this before I could do the thing that I want to do. So that's just kind of briefly touching upon, you know, where some of these meditation teachers and people in the meditation sphere don't have the privilege that we have in safer countries to say, well, I'm going to let Caesar be unto Caesar, and I'm going to focus on spiritual development because that's my calling. That's a privileged view for Myanmar right now. But to answer the question that you did ask and follow that up, you know, how is it, how are they being informed by this? You know, I think he and others, their inner transformation of Buddhist practice, it informs everything they do. You know, when you ask those questions, whether it's a metta practice where they're learning about loving kindness. I mean, I can't tell you how many political prisoners I've talked to that have suffered in ways that we cannot even begin to understand, that don't have even a trace of anger towards the people who did that to them, or democratic leaders or activists that are constantly in hiding and unsafe and have lost so much. And same thing, even when they're trying to defeat the military, there's so many that I've talked to that are not trying to defeat them from a place of anger, hatred, or retribution, but because this is a wrong person doing a wrong thing that everyone else is suffering from. So they're taking strong action to try to stop that wrong from happening and try to reset their country on a path of federal democracy. And they are taking that very strong action, whether it's some, you know, not always the case of actually armed movements, but it could be that, but it also might be in the case of advocacy or of protest or resistance in some other way, or news or media, or being a democratic leader. What's driving them in doing that is not their sect to get on top or them to get some kind of personal accolades or this, that, or the other. It's more of realizing that strong force is the only thing that's called upon now, but trying to separate that strong force from wanting to also preserve their humanity and preserve their ethics, and being guided by these Buddhist principles of Sila, of the precepts that they're following, of the morality, of the loving kindness, understanding of that of a Nietzsche, this constant changing that's going on, and trying to live in that. And I think, you know, every activist, every individual is calls upon different parts of these meditative experiences and ethics to guide them in different ways. But, you know, so many of them have expressed how this has calmed the mind. That's something that's come a lot. There's a lot of talk about the calming the mind, about the stress and the trauma, and what they do to balance the mind, whether it's observing their breath, observing their abdomen, sitting in meditation, just observing their thoughts, just knowing that these are thoughts that are passing through, they don't need to cling to them. And so many have talked about what that balance of mind has done to be able to then go the next day and respond to the next day.
I mean, you posed a question that you asked some of them of, should a Buddhist monk or should the monastery be involved? I mean, for me, it's a relevant question, but on one hand, I feel like, how can that even be a question? Like, when people, as you say, are suffering trauma, when there's so much space for Buddhist values to be used for building a better society, it feels somewhat sometimes surprising that, like, it's so divided, that this is a meditative spiritual practice and you're on a hill and then the rest of the world is just functioning. You're supposedly guiding the world, but there's no connection.
Right. Yeah, and it's opposed to the system the Buddha himself set up, where there's this reciprocal nature between the lay and the Sangha. That's the way he set it up to be able to continue into further generations.
Yeah, and then just another example of the many ways maybe we've strayed away from the original essence of the Dhamma, if you will, and of practice. But also touching on what you referenced, you talked about, you know, metta, you talked about calming the mind, very, you know, core practices of Buddhism. I think of Krishnamurti, who often talked about how we need evolution, not revolution, and this idea that we're constantly just replacing the same, something old with something new, but that looks different, but it's the same. And this idea that Myanmar maybe has this opportunity to truly build a new democracy that could be radically different, and maybe true to democracy, the more true than any other democracy in the world today. How do you see a Myanmar that might be reimagined along Buddhist lines, not in a religious sense or an institutional sense, but in truly bringing in these values?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things there. You know, first, what is a reimagined post-military Myanmar looking like? And then where's the Buddhist place in that, and the Buddhist values going into it? And I think regarding where it's going, I do think that you're right. They have, as terrible as things are now, they do have the possibility, and they have a real challenge ahead of them. You know, it is not easy. We cannot sugarcoat this. Not just when the military falls, but when how they bring all these groups together. It is a real challenge. But if they're able to navigate and find a way through, and there's certainly the dedication to like never before, they have a way to bring something into history I don't know if we've ever seen in the world. And, you know, they're inspiring their neighbors. You know, people might talk about how Myanmar is this failed state or this conflict zone, and that might be true to some degree, but it's also like when I talk to people across Milk Tea Alliance or different regional actors, transnational grassroots activists across Southeast Asia, which we've done on the podcast, they talk about Myanmar as the light. Myanmar is the place that's inspiring them. It's showing them what's possible. It's showing them that what people can do. They're facing something so much more serious and intense than the other problems across Southeast Asia, which are nothing to be undermined. They are definitely very serious issues that are going across Southeast Asia, but nothing like in Myanmar, nothing of those extremes. And to see people, their contemporaries and their peers, responding to the situation in Myanmar the way that they are showing them what's possible and what could be done in their countries. And so it's not even a hypothetical, it's happening now, you know, and it's just this flipping the narrative, which is what we need to do, to not look at Myanmar as this place where all the bad things are happening, but to look at it as the place where, when all these bad things are happening, could you ever imagine that this amount of resilience is even possible? Could you imagine that people can rise up and coalesce and show the resilience they have, that this could actually happen in our world today? You know, this is something to be celebrated, and it is lighting the activist community and kind of democratic movements of Southeast Asia right now. If it's able to proceed and to defeat an armed military by Russia, by China, and then try to hold to these values and construct something of a federal democracy, that while so-called democratic countries in the world or countries that hold these ideals and haven't been supporting, they do it all on their own, this is all the more so. But where the Buddhist values come in, you know, I think that to me, like, what I really want to see is a way to hold to these values without fear, because that's something that I think has really caused the damage before. And not just, you know, in the last 10 years, really looking back through decades or even centuries of Burmese society and this this fear, because built into the fabric of Buddhism and the Buddhist teachings is that this, like everything else, is impermanent. These teachings are one day going to be diluted and going to be lost. And so there's this intrinsic fear in a Buddhist of any era that this pathway to liberation might close during this lifetime. And so there are benign ways to preserve the teachings to make sure this doesn't happen. And there are malevolent and really dangerous and violent ways to do that. And we've seen both in Myanmar. We've seen very benign ways that they've tried to, Lady Sayadaw is the great example of how he tried to preserve and keep these teachings alive in a time of difficulty. And we've seen ways that have been built on fear and hatred that are coming from the same place of this fear of the teachings leaving. But where, you know, when you think that you need to preserve these teachings and this religion out of force, you know, then you have state policies, then you have violence, then you have fears of Muslim invasion, then you have prejudice and bias, you tearing down crosses and building pagodas. These are all these insecurities. As to quote Shin Kovita again, you don't need to worry about any of this. Dhamma's fine. Dhamma's going to take care of itself. We lose Dhamma by not practicing. We lose Dhamma by being forceful and aggressive. That's what makes us lose it. But we keep the Dhamma by practicing and by meditating. That's how we make it strong. And so, you know, someone who really has this true value in faith, they're not afraid of Christian churches and mosques and the economy improving and opportunities and education and connection with other countries. Just like Lady Sayadaw wasn't afraid of English language. He wasn't afraid of biology. He wasn't afraid of technology, of science. Other monks were. They were afraid of all those things. And so they tried to close that. They saw that as a threat. He saw that as like, my faith in the Buddhist teachings are so strong, bring it all in. I'm going to talk to foreigners. I'm going to write to them. I'm going to read the translated works of all these new developments in technology. And then I'm going to use these analogies and examples to reframe Buddhism of why it's true. You know, I'm not going to be afraid of this. And so, like, that's what I hope happens, is I hope that they're able to find a way to take these values and these Buddhist inspirations and influences and to realize that they don't need to fear anything if they really hold them the right way. You don't need a state apparatus to put everyone else down so that your faith and religious structures can have dominancy. And that's actually not going to benefit you in the long run. That's a shortcut to actually losing your religion than gaining and extending your faith.
Yeah. I really love that you said, you know, moving away from fear. It's certainly one of the Light Forest protocols of living fearlessly and learning to act, if you will, fight, if you will, but not from a place of anger and fear, but from a different space. And it's heartwarming to know then that there are people there who are, you know, building the institutions or sort of building or reimagining Myanmar coming from this space. Because my fear, if you will, is that in through this violent period of fighting and revolution, even if the federated democracy is able to come through, my fear is that it will recreate something that looks different, but it's largely the same. And then we're just caught in the samsara, if you will, of creation and destruction rather than an evolution into something different. But it sounds like that there are seeds being planted and there are movements that are there that might push Myanmar into something radically different. Because also, as I learn, I know very little about Myanmar history, but as I do learn a little bit, is that, you know, even the idea of Myanmar is not very old.
And still contested.
And it's a colonial, you know,
absolutely.
It's a colonial project as well. So this idea of being attached to some version of Myanmar that itself is maybe not that helpful is, and maybe just allowing a reimagination that could be truly something different.
Yeah, and, you know, to tag on to that, I think that to see this evolution playing out since the coup is really brilliant. You know, to give one example, there was a Burmese Buddhist who I was friends with. And before the coup, there was this art exhibit, and featured into the art was an art exhibit talking about the dangers of air pollution coming to Yangon with the new development. And someone had painted a picture, a Burmese Buddhist, presumably, had painted a picture of the Buddha in Yangon, in modern day Yangon, wearing a gas mask to show that even the Buddha focusing on in-breath, out-breath couldn't breathe the air because it was so toxic. And this resulted in such an anger among the Burmese Buddhist community. They wanted the artist, you know, strung up and jailed and maybe even executed. They were so angry that the Buddha was depicted this way. Even though I didn't see any offense to the Buddha, I thought it was about the air quality. But the problem was that with this was that obviously there was, you know, just as they had kind of gained more freedoms through the transition period, they were then asking for those freedoms to be taken away because they didn't agree with the kind of content or art being created, rather than discuss it or rather than create other art or have a conversation. And one Buddhist friend in particular was so angry. He said, there's no place for this. I don't want this vision. I don't want to live in a society like this. I don't care what happens to the artist, but he needs to be punished. After the coup, he, and you know, along with that, he's also kind of a nationalist Buddhist and just believed in, you know, Buddhism needed state support. After the coup, and he saw the danger that everyone now fell under, and went through a transition himself of his activism and his protest, his resistance, and what he did to try to fight against the military, he realized very clearly that could not survive in a society where it had this state dominance over other religions and cultures, that if one person wasn't free, no one was free, that kind of thing. He learned that experientially. And so he's coming from a place where he actually wanted to see punishment of someone who created an art that he didn't agree with. On the podcast, I asked him about that directly. I said, "Going, you know, you remember we argued about this. What do you see that now?" He's like, "No, absolutely. That art needs to have a place, whether I agree with it or not. You know, the LGBT community, the Muslim community, the ethnic communities, all of them, if they are not free, then that same violence and lack of freedom can be given to me." And I asked him also, like, "You're such a devout Buddhist. You spend so much time in monasteries. Buddhist ethics guide your life. Do you hold the same fear you held before, that Buddhism needs this real strong support to be able to survive and thrive at the expense of their places?" He said, "Absolutely not. That's actually what's going to kill us. We need to be strong enough in our own community and with our own faith that we're upholding those values and everyone else is upholding theirs." So in a strange way, you know, the coup, the violence the military instituted and instigated, this showed a lot of devout Buddhists like him that it made them change their mindset and their beliefs, because they saw that this was not good for them and their community and not good for others, and that they needed, you know, so their more kind of tolerant, open, progressive form of Buddhism did not come through kumbaya moments of trying to convince them otherwise. It came from experientially seeing that this was the only way that their faith and their community was going to survive alongside everyone else's.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you referenced Myanmar as a beacon of hope. And I think for me, from the outside looking in, what I find remarkable is you have a group of people who saw something, had a direct experience of violence, and they decided that, you know, they were not going to get reillusioned into believing, like, and to put their bodies and put their lives on the line and go fight, which is something that none of us in our countries have. You know, we might get disillusioned, but then we just go back to the illusion. But yeah, and here's people who are really fighting, and in some sense, Myanmar is almost the future of the world. Like, if whatever happens there might actually play out in so many other parts of the world, where I know in the technology front, like, that's another area, you know, we look at, and how the activists and people are fighting to the resilience you referenced about staying online despite no, you know, telecom connectivity, and finding all kinds of, you know, ways to be connected in a very disconnected place. And it's really remarkable. Can I ask you, I mean, how have you changed since, your journey in Myanmar will be long, but let's just say since you started, over time, and since you started the podcast as well, speaking to all these people, how have you felt your perspective or outlook, how have you changed or evolved?
Yeah, so I can answer that in two ways. One, I could look at the podcast, and another, I can look at, you know, post-coup, and they kind of intersect, but they're also
on their own tracks.
So the podcast was originally about Buddhism and spirituality, and after the podcast, after the coup, we transitioned to a wider range of subjects. But, you know, how the podcast has changed me is that the wisdom of my guests lives in my mind. You know, every guest has said something I've never forgotten. I swear you could pick a number and tell me that guest's name, and I could tell you, oh yeah, this is what they said and this is how it changed me. We have over 300 guests. We have, if you listen to our podcast back to back, it's 15 days of continuous listening. So it's a lot of content, but it's content with people who have wisdom, who are living brave and courageous lives on many cases in spiritual paths, incredibly intelligent people who've taken great risks, so just the gamut. And their insights from their unique perspectives, as different as they are, have given me things I've never forgotten. In some ways, reformulated the way I look at everything. Just one sentence that's just like, and how many times have I quoted this person, as I did during this interview.
Insight.
Or, Ashin Kovita said this, or Chitun, that's the guy I talked about, the Burmese Buddhist, he said this, to really pin down, like, everything changed on a dime when I heard this thing. It reformulated everything. In terms of the coup itself, it was, the first year was really tough. I was in the U.S. because of the pandemic, and I had never had to deal with these kind of issues before. And it was really tough for me to live in to be in a quote-unquote normal society, conventional reality, going to the supermarket, planning for meals, taking walks, talking to a friend or family member about a TV show they watched, while I was having friends that were on the run, in prison, escaping death, or in some cases not escaping it, and just this trauma and tragedy. And it was that first year, it was anything you get adjusted to, and humans can adapt to anything, but that first year, to try to live in those two worlds, and just to live in the world of, even though I wasn't in that, I wasn't on the ground facing those things, that's very important to note, there is second degree trauma. And that second degree trauma of, your phone buzzing at any moment, and the kind of dangers that were happening, and from a distance trying to learn how you could help and what you could do, that was a really hard transition to go through. But it's a transition that so many of us did go through, whether we're on the ground or helping from a distance, and just trying to figure out where our place is in this and what we can do. Well, I think, first of all, it all goes back to the five precepts and Shila that I learned early on in my meditative journey, not to take intoxicants, not to lie, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct, and not to kill. And of course, that includes insects as well. And just that following, I think in the West, sometimes we want to go on these great spiritual adventures and don't realize the role that ethics and morality play into that. That was a real shock to me when I started meditating, was that I couldn't go on these great meditative journeys without a stable mind. And it was ethics that made that stable mind and created that stability. So I think that's one thing that has me rooted of whatever situation I'm in, knowing that this ethical understanding is always going to keep me grounded, safe, stable, out of danger, and as far as I can be. So much of it starts there for me. I think beyond that, it's the time that I've spent on the cushion and the insights that have come to me will reframe everything I'm experiencing kind of in their own way and give me insights when just kind of bring things up to help me out in ways that I couldn't produce if I tried, or wasn't really expecting, just from that background of insight. One example is sometimes I'll talk to other activists that will talk about feeling overwhelmed by how much is in front of them and how much they're trying to do. And I think one thing that meditation has taught me is in my meditative journey is that my meditation practice is recognizing I don't have control over outcomes, but I have control over inputs. That was not the way I was before meditation. I was very, very controlling and tense about the outcomes that would be produced. And it was very hard for me to let go of that in meditation practice. But to be able to learn through direct meditation that the nature will take care of the outcomes, but I can keep putting the right inputs, and eventually the outcomes are going to match. But I don't know when or how. I'll trust the process. Trusting the process is a big thing. But I'm just going to I'm going to work on what's in front of me. Not beyond that, just what's in front of me. That's the same way I approach this crisis. If something is in front of me, something's on my desk, if I could do something about it, I'll focus all my energy and effort into it. If something is outside of that realm, no matter how bad it is or how terrible, it doesn't affect me emotionally. I mean, usually, sometimes it's still well, but mostly it's like I'm not cutting it off. I'm not bypassing it. I'm aware of it. I'm feeling it, but I'm not getting drained from it. I'm accepting that this is happening, but if it's not in front of me, I only have limited resources. I need to focus those resources on what I could actually do. So that's another part of it. I think another thing, to quote another podcast guest, as I've said these words that resound in my mind, speaking to Yeshua, who is a landmine expert and also has his own meditation practice, he talked about his activism, that other activists he's around, that their activism is fueled by hatred or rage at an unjust system, and that burns itself out and it can't be sustained. He talks about his activism being fueled by mindfulness and selflessness and trying to detach from ego through what he does, and that allows him to sustain it much longer. And I think I have there's something in me that resonates with that. My work is for sure not fueled by hatred. I don't want anyone to suffer. When I have any bit of tension or anger towards someone, I check in with myself. Do I really, I might want this person to be disempowered and not have the control this person has, not cause the suffering he causes another, but do I actually want this person to physically or mentally undergo a process of suffering? Like, no, why would I want that? Like, what do I get from that? I don't want that. And just the fact of freeing yourself or releasing yourself from, you know, really trying to get done what you're trying to do in very difficult circumstances and knowing that the result of what you're doing, you might have to take hard action and that hard action might, you know, people, that hard action is going to have an effect on what it does, but you don't actually intentionally want anyone to suffer from anything that you're doing. You know, that clears the mind. It doesn't make you weak. It doesn't make you a pushover. It doesn't make you a couch potato or, you know, passive or anything else. It doesn't even make you a pacifist. But it just makes you very clear intentioned that, like, you're going to try to take the right action. And that right action might be hard to determine. It might be hard to implement. And it might have effects on those around that are being implemented. But you don't, but your intention is very clearly, I don't actually want anyone to suffer. And being able to know that and kind of cling to it, it does give you this sense of security in yourself, this sense of brightness that, you know, that's not dragging you down. Because to want someone to suffer, you know, it's been so long since I ever felt that from my Buddhist meditation that, that, you know, I don't even quite remember what it's like to hold that. But, you know, it's got to just, you know, drain you so much to actually actively want someone else for needlessly to go through something that doesn't even concern you. So.
Oh, that's remarkable. I mean, it's an inspiration, I think, for all of us to see how we can balance this practice with intense activity and creation, podcasting, and connecting humanitarian relief and just supporting the movement. And hearing you speak, I could also imagine that, you know, the place that you're coming from would come from a different energy as well, right? Where if you're able to keep these practices for yourself, then what you're creating was, you know, actually a friend of mine told me this wonderful anecdote that stuck with me as well, which is about in some temples, the monks instruct the practitioners that if they're feeling angry, don't serve food, because there's an energy transference. And when I speak to monks as well, Sun monks tell me about everything has an energy. And if you're coming from that place of anger, then what you create, even if you're trying to help people, yeah, what you're being created still comes with that, yeah, energy. And that's something that's hard to see, but it's there. And it's incredible that you're able to keep your practice amidst all this busy activity.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to create, and the way that I want to create is through the voices and community of others, bringing those out. You know, not like I'm some great genius or authority that, you know, I'm gonna be the one spouting off. But by, I often tell people, I don't, even though podcast is in a media space, I don't come from a media background. I come from a training background. The training that I do is about creating safe spaces, vulnerability, rapport, trust, connection, going places you haven't gone in conversation before, active listening. These are the things I'm trying to bring to the podcast. And so, you know, I want to create a space. I don't want to create a manifesto that everyone comes and compliments. I want to create a space that is a co-creative space that is really involving three entities. Is involving me and the guest and what we put together. And then the third entity is, I like to call it the invisible chair, where the listener, you know, weeks, months, or even years from now is going to be sitting in that invisible chair. So how can we co-create a conversation that doesn't just connect us, but that also leaves a space for that invisible listener to come and feel like they're a part of, and feel like they're arguing with us, they're hugging us, they're wanting to get their points in, they're reflecting on something because of what we say, it involves them. So how can we co-create a space where these three entities can come together? And I think everyone wins. We don't have to agree. One truth doesn't have to defeat another truth. It could be a place where we hold all our realities simultaneously and we just acknowledge their existence. And isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Joa, for bringing your light and creation into the world and helping many of us, you know, learn. And I think this world of spirituality mixed with politics and movements isn't easy. But I feel like there's a sense that these worlds are converging more and more. I think you alluded to earlier as well about meditation, maybe something much more niche 20 years ago. But today it's becoming more accepted, more mainstreamed in positive ways. I hope that this movement that you're building continues to grow, and we can see this reimagined Myanmar sooner rather than later.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on. Thank you for creating spaces in Chiang Mai to speak, you know, for being interested in this and opening up to this. So thank you also for what you've brought into your platform and yourself with these conversations.
And there you have it. Thank you so much for joining this podcast and listening to this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. There is so much to unpack still. Links in the show notes will send you to many of Jua's podcasts that he refers to, among other resources. And like I mentioned earlier in the start of the episode, there's also links to rescue efforts. There's also links to relief efforts by Better Burma and other close collaborators in the show notes. Please check them out and do what you can to spread the message to support the people in Myanmar right now. They really need it. With that, I will end the episode here. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day and week ahead. And if you haven't subscribed already, do subscribe to the Light Forest podcast. You can subscribe on Substack. You can subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other major podcast platforms of your choice. All right, goodbye.